The fact that up until very recently, Osama bin Laden has been America's favorite play toy, as far as his our continuing support of his operations, both in Afghanistan and in other areas, such as Chechnya, and his relatively bizarre about face and never mentioning it being totally against any sort of Palestinian operations right up until the time of the World Trade Center, and then after that linking the Palestinian cause to the and the fact that they've left the Taliban have done what they're traditionally doing, the Afghans traditionally do. What do you see as the an incredibly smart and otherwise globally savvy individual like Mr. Bin Laden would all of a sudden do a complete 180 degree?
I think it's the 180 degree turn.
The man who organized, I'm not as facile with names. The man who helped the Palestinian, and right as the operations were winding down there, and this has been in the news reports, he wanted to take the Afghan fighters and bring them back to the West Bank. He wanted to take the war back to Israel. Who was his main person who was opposed him and literally put his party? Bin Laden. He was absolutely against bringing the war anywhere near the West Bank or Israel. He wanted to take it to all the other areas. So he commits the greatest act of terrorism in the 20th century, and what's the first name that he puts out as a thing? The Palestinian cause, and they are furious at him for doing that. Now, because none of those people supported blowing up building.
Does anybody else know who this Palestinian that Bill's talking about is?
I think he means really an Egyptian. There was a split between the...
Right.
This was on NPR not too long ago.
So that was really about Al-Zawahiri?
No. We're going back farther
It was mostly Saudi eyes and Egyptians. I wasn't aware that there were Palestinians who were involved in any capacity.
According to the New York Times, Bin Laden on his mother's side is either Syrian or Palestinian. They didn't seem to be able to decide.
I always heard she was like Alawite, Syrian Alawite. But I think that, you know, he's Israel and, you know, Palestine has always been at the top of the list of his gripes. His three gripes have always been pretty consistent. And this is a really bitter pill for people to swallow in this country. So that Osama bin Laden's methods are utterly criminal. His ideology is utterly totalitarian. And, it's impossible to like him or give any legitimacy to him. But nonetheless, his demands are just. I mean, it's kind of taboo to say it. And it's a real... And it's a difficult, his demands that women wear veils are not just, no. But his three top demands, which he put in his communique, that, a Palestinian state, an end to the U.S. military presence in Saudi Arabia, and an end to the bombardment of Iraq, we can't argue with those demands. Now, I'd really like to bring the discussion in terms of, what our response here in New York and generally in the West is going to be. But this in particular puts us in a very dangerous situation. Because how do we embrace these demands without embracing Osama bin Laden?
I just wanted to interject ask a question. Could you just speak up? I mean, the people who have spoken have done fine. Well, for him and for, it's going to go on the AM Plus Radio Project online.
Just before you ended your talk, President Bush turned around in his policy.
Well, ostensibly, they were doing that at the behest of the United States.
They never thought they'd actually do it.
That's it. And ostensibly doing it at the behest of the United Nations and the so-called international community. No, I think that they just realized that, the Taliban were not, contrary to what they had been hoping, were not a group that they could play ball with in terms of, building oil pipelines and stuff like that. And that, in fact, the Taliban were going to... give refuge to people who like to hurl airplanes at skyscrapers. If in fact, I mean, you know, obviously there's been a lot of duplicity. I mean, the State Department has been saying one thing and doing another with Afghanistan right from the very beginning. And I don't, you know, doubt that, that could be the case even now. For instance, with all of this, if you read between the lines in the paper, there's all this talk about how the State Department is trying to find, you know, these Taliban moderates who they can incorporate into a new coalition government in Afghanistan. And, you know, the old joke when, you know, the Reagan administration was looking for Iranian moderates is, you know, an Iranian moderate is one who's out of ammunition. But you know, this is all, you know, once again about the whole shadow war with Russia, which is going on here, because, you know, Russia doesn't want to hear about any Taliban moderates, and but the U.S. realizes that you know, ultimately if these Tajiks and Uzbeks in the Northern Alliance take power, it, you know, not only is it going to extend the war, but it's going to give Russia more control than they want Russia to have in Afghanistan. Yeah, Danny.
All right. Another aim of Bin Laden's that has been talked about a bit, but you really didn't mention it, and I think it's part of the whole matter. All the totalitarian regimes are legitimate, but he wants the Arabian Peninsula for himself. And, you know, the fact is that as much as the Saudi monarchy is grimacing at what we're doing there, you know, they're happy to see us eliminate the Taliban.
Maybe. I think that the Saudi monarchy is sort of playing a very duplicitous game, too. And I think they always have been. I think they've been talking out of both sides of their mouth about the whole thing. They still continue to be one of only three regimes on Earth which recognize
the Taliban. Only Pakistan was the last one, and I think they said...
They broke off diplomatic relations, but not recognition.
The Saudis, the United Arab...
It's my understanding that they broke off diplomatic relations, but not recognition, and there's a distinction between the two. But in any event...
But the also the Taliban, I mean, they're, you know, more Wahhabi than the Saudis.
Right,
they're
exactly.
Still coming out of that Wahhabi thing. They were so well-educated in that incredible, you know, extremism,
right,
which makes, again, Iran look quite
right,
moderate,
exactly,
where women
exactly,
can, you know,
exactly,
serve in parliament,
yeah,
and
yeah,
vote.
Yeah.
And, I mean, well, nobody can vote in Saudi Arabia, our dearly beloved ally. But also about the his demands being reasonable. Of course, his demand, you know, obviously... It would be a blessing for the world if Iraq were not, you know, 5,000 children a month were not dying in Iraq, which personally I think is a greater act of terrorism here in the 20th. But as for getting, you know, of course it would be nice to get troops out of Saudi Arabia, but he doesn't really care that they're troops.
No, I think
he cares that they're infidels. There must be no non-Muslims. And of course, his definition of Muslim is very, very narrow right there. But there must be no, you know, non-Muslims in Arabia.
Well,
this is, you know,
the fact that they're military. The fact that they're military makes it more offensive to him. But
Well, they're crusaders.
They're crusaders. I mean, he's still got his sympathizers within the Saudi regime. And just like the U.S. is playing this cynical game of, you know, maybe we can find some Taliban we can deal with to help us fight the Russians and Iran again, you know, when the alliances shift. There's elements in the Saudi regime which are thinking exactly the same thing, you know, because they're going to continue to see Iran as an enemy, and they're going to continue to see the Northern Alliance as an enemy. And they're going to continue to, you know, they've got all these Wahhabi connections and so on with the Taliban. And right now, you know, some of these Taliban have just gotten a little bit too out of control, but there's all sorts of duplicity on every side. Kevin?
You sort of frame your discussion in terms of a kind of U.S. of Russia. In Egypt, they're trying to overthrow the United States. They try to overthrow, the military.
Yeah.
They look at, in other words, there are so many different points.
But then now they're not.
So no, not just now, but for a long time before. And in fact, one of the
I agree with you. You know, I don't disagree at all. But I do think that, you know, dealing with the Russians is still generals are always fighting the last war, right? And I do think that Kissinger and Javrinsky and their lot are very concerned about how the Russians play into all of this. And of course, you know, despite the fact that there's been a warrant out for Bin Laden's arrest ever since the bombings in Africa in 1998, and the U.S. actually, you know, bombed Afghanistan in 1998 in retaliation. And despite the fact that Madeleine Albright was making all of these noises about how evil the Taliban is, I mean, you also have to keep in mind that at the same time, the CIA was aiding the Taliban under the table through Pakistan, and the State Department was bringing Taliban leaders, top-ranking Taliban leaders, to Dallas, Texas, to meet with the UNICAL people.
But don't you say their argument would be that this is a way to bring in the Taliban to pull them away from the plot? I mean, this is sort of like the soft version of a sort of a counterinsurgency strategy.
Well, you know, on one hand, I agree with you. On the other hand, I think that that you know the yahoos and the extremists within the even by Taliban standards, extremists within the within the Taliban have been very useful to U.S. imperialism in terms of, you know, blowing up Russian oil pipelines and that sort of thing.
It's a hard call.
Yes, yes.
And one of the Saudi fears, actually, one of the reasons why the Saudi monarchy is so.
Yes.
And in this context, I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit more about what you're talking about, who in Soviet foreign policy against the Eurasian,
absolutely.
So Eurasian,
absolutely.
Serbia, you know, Iran orientation,
absolutely.
To a much more Gorbachev-like
right.
policy on Putin.
Yeah.
My question is, and I don't know if the answer to this question is, why do you
because they see the opportunity to actually get rid of the Taliban, which they think is going to, you know, buy them a certain amount of stability, enable them to maintain at least some kind of, you know, token control over former Soviet lands in Central Asia.
Right.
And which is why if they if they actually succeed in that, you know, then who's the enemy going to be after that? The enemy is going to be all of these U.S. military troops which have established a presence here, and Chevron, which is trying to seal their oil as they see it, which is why I really think that there's a big risk that the, you know, these so-called Eurasianists and Stalin nostalgists and so on are going to come back with a vengeance in the near future.
I just want to point out those there are still Soviet republics and treated as such, but part of that.
Well, see, yeah.
And they take orders from Moscow.
To a certain extent. If they were completely, if they were completely taking orders from Moscow, they wouldn't be signing deals with UNICAL and Chevron.
But you also have to remember that the Russians are wanting U.S. investment and Western investment in Russia.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and in Central Asia.
You know, it's not as simple as a kind of like building block, you know.
Right, and my fear is that Putin and these guys are going to be swept aside by the Stalin nostalgists.
That's more inside Russia itself.
Yeah, or anybody else who hasn't spoken yet. Yeah.
Responding to your first question about the problems with bin Laden's demands and their sort of, you know, appeal, I think it actually represents, it's very thorny that it represents a really great opportunity for American activists. Because what it is it's the fact that they're relatively reasonable, although it there's a danger of needing to distance yourself and make sure that you're clear about, you know, being, you know, abhorring these methods and not endorsing terrorism and this and that. That's actually, it can be kind of useful because a lot of Americans are very susceptible to those kinds of appeals. Like if you couch it in very patriotic anti-terrorist terms, repulsive to us, but, you know, it's realistic about the way you have to frame the debate. But when you start talking about the bans, you can start opening up a dialogue about what U.S. policy really has been, what the complications and double dealing has really been. And, I mean, it may sound naive, but I mean, one hope would be to actually take some of this, like video journalists, taking some of this to places like Pakistan or Iran or other places and opening up spaces for dialogue there where there's room for people there to actually give Americans feedback on what they think all of this is about and what's going on and what they're so pissed off about. And it has two actions. One, it informs a lot of Americans if you can get it broadcast. And two, it also, in a sense, radicalizes cultures over there and works against the extreme elements within their own culture who shut down spaces for debate and don't allow people to discuss issues. Now they can do something as corny as it sounds, like, you know, a George Bush town hall meeting where it's like, you can sell the U.S. what you think is wrong with U.S. policy, you know, in Pakistan or this or that. I think there are a lot of people over there that would be hungry for some option to be able to express, you know, ideas clearly and say, this is why we're angry. You know, this is what's going on. This is what the U.S. has done.
When you say over there, what do you mean by over there?
I'm talking about taking journalists to places like Pakistan or Iran and engaging people in some more of a debate. And I think they would have a profound democratizing influence on both sides of the border, like for Americans and also for those cultures themselves that have been deprived of a lot of democratic dialogue.
Well,
like I said, it may sound naive, but it's an opportunity.
The first thing we have to grapple with is how we're going to talk to people in New York City, people, you know, who we live with and work with and so on. That, you know, that, establishing a dialogue with them, which is what started to happen. And one of the things which has given me a great deal of hope in this generally dismal landscape since the attacks is what we saw in Union Square Park, where New Yorkers spontaneously came together and took over that park and turned it into a public forum. And not only, the two really beautiful things about it, one is that it really was under the control of the people. And the government because, you know, the city was so tense, you know, Giuliani backed off. And for like, what, 2 weeks, he actually let it happen. Now he's, you know, they're starting to retake it again. That was the first thing that was really beautiful about it, is that it was a spontaneous, public, forum, celebration, memorial, etc., which was not coming down from the authorities, but the authorities were outmaneuvered into having to tolerate it. That was the first thing that was beautiful about it. The second thing that was beautiful about it is that there were a lot of pro-peace sentiments there. And even, you know, the people who came out there to wave American flags and to be patriotic, and even the people who came out there to support war, generally tolerated and got along with and were able to debate and dialogue with the people who were out there to talk about peace. And the people who were out there to talk about peace were the majority. So that was the other really beautiful thing about it. But that was in the first 2 weeks after the attack, when everybody was in shock and everybody was, you know, treating everybody else very carefully and trying not to offend people. And even, you know, motorists in New York City weren't leaning on their fucking horns the way they do. Well, now if you notice, they've gone back to leaning on their horns again. So now it's sort of, you know, the debate is beginning to go back to normal and the usual, you know, ultra patriotic jingoist attitudes which you start seeing in times like these are coming to the fore again. So my question to you and everybody else here is, if we are going to, you know, say as you suggest, that, you know, Osama, we have to face the fact that Osama bin Laden's demands are just, of course, you know, his methods are terrible and we don't support terrorism, blah 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 blah. You're going to get two responses. The first response is that it's going to sound like a weak, you know, just afterthought to, you know, disavow the terrorism. It's going to sound like a weak afterthought. And secondly, which is related, the response is going to be, well, you know, you think, and I'll tell you, because I've actually got this response from talking to people in my family and so on. You know, the response is going to be, what, so you think that we should give in to terrorist demands? You think that we should just, you know, give them what they want and knuckle under? You think we should be that weak? So that's what you're going to run into. And I don't see any way out of it. You know, despite the fact that there are some glimmers of hope on the landscape, and, you know, I feel, you know, pretty good about what happened in Union Square Park for the first 2 weeks. Nonetheless, you know, I really feel, in terms of effective anti-war propaganda, I feel like we're looking at a Gordian knot. I don't know where we should begin. So if anybody has any, you know, brilliant answers, I'd like to hear them. Anybody who hasn't spoken yet? Petra?
Well, actually, this may just be the beginning. Do you have any recommendations for the best places to get news about Latin? First-hand news, whether it would be in-print website.
Yeah, subscribe to Weekly News Update on the Americas, which is produced by the Nicaragua Solidarity Network of Greater New York. They're based down at 339 Lafayette Street, Room 8. Great newsletter. They work really hard on it. They get it out every week. They monitor the press throughout the hemisphere. They do a damn good job.
Does anybody provide
what?
The better, you know, like the newspapers. Translation.
From what countries?
Down Central
America? They do. For starters. You know, there's also, what I like about them is that even though it's produced by the Nicaragua Network, they cover all of Latin America. And they do it very comprehensively, very concisely, very objectively. Anybody else? Yeah, Amy.
Hey, what do you think about the state's it's not the Taliban, it's really us.
Okay, this is, you know, something which I thought maybe we could weasel out of addressing tonight, but...
Sorry.
No, you shouldn't apologize. And actually, it's important. I mean, one of the big problems, which particularly we as, I'm not even going to say just as anarchists, okay, but including anarchists in a larger sphere of generally anti-authoritarian and generally principled leftists, How do we deal with all of the really hideous, reactionary, totalitarian elements which are on the left, particularly in New York City and more generally in you know the country and in the world? And you know, one of them is this Ralph Schoenman character. Forgive me if anybody here is a fan of his, who's the guru of the week on WBAI, who is just giving this absolute, total revisionist bunk crapola about the Soviet role in Afghanistan in the 1980s and how they were really just trying to liberate Afghanistan, and they were really about giving women their rights and instituting land reform and blah 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 blah, and just absolute just revisionism straight up. Just completely overlooking, the massacres, the aerial bombardment, the forced relocations, all of the very same shit which the left quite rightly is the first to protest when the U.S. imperialism does it in Southeast Asia or in Central America or in the Andes, we're the first to protest it. But when, the certain segments of the left, that when the Soviet Union did it or when the Serbs do it, we're supposed to turn a blind eye and ignore it. And particularly in terms of anti-war organizing here in New York City, the biggest fucking pain in the ass that we have to deal with is the International Action Center led by Ramsey Clark, which is of course a front for the Workers' World Party, which is just overtly waving pom-poms for the likes of Saddam Hussein and Slobodan Milosevic and Radovan Karadzic and any any pathetic little despot who happens to be on the White House shit list on a particular week, even if they're actually creations of U.S. imperialism, as all of them were. Manuel Noriega, Saddam Hussein.
So you think he's going to come to the support of Bin Laden next?
All of those people who the IAC is waving pom-poms for are actually the creations of U.S. imperialism. That's the ultimate irony. I don't think that the IAC is going to support Osama bin Laden, because the IAC is extremely Soviet nostalgist, and the Russians don't like Osama either. So they're probably not going to support Osama. But they are going to support those Stalin nostalgists in the Kremlin that Kevin was just talking about. And it really, it irks the hell out of me that such, I would say even a majority of the anti-war opposition in New York City are willing to work with them, are willing to march with them. And it completely delegitimizes us. I mean, the first thing that we have to say in terms of our propaganda, I think the only way we can begin to turn, this horrific turn of events into something positive, and we have to begin. Ground zero is attacks on civilians are not acceptable. Okay, now the New York City has been attacked, and now that we've got 5,000 dead here in New York City, 5,000 innocent civilians just randomly attacked because of the building they happen to work in New York City. A little bit. Of the kind of thing which the U.S. has been funding in Colombia and in Central America and in Southeast Asia and all over the world for generations, a little bit of that has finally come back to the homeland now. So maybe if we play our cards right, we can begin to use this to sensitize people to the reality of war, to the reality of mass murder, to the reality of attacks on civilians. So then we can actually get up on our soapbox in Union Square and say, look, there's bombs falling on innocent civilians in Afghanistan right now. Innocent civilians who are suffering under the Taliban, who've got nothing to do with Osama bin Laden, are getting their houses blown up and their families destroyed by U.S. aerial bombardment. And if we don't think that it was very nice for Osama bin Laden to do it to us here in New York, then maybe it's not so nice for the United States to be doing it to innocent civilians in Kabul, Afghanistan. Right? We can begin to make that argument, and maybe we can begin to make some inroads and to re-inject some actual humanity back into the debate if we play our cards right. But if we're going to line up behind people who are actually supporting war crimes, then we're playing our cards dead wrong. And when the most demoralized, I think, about the prospects of ever getting any real anti-war opposition off the ground was during the bombardment of Yugoslavia 2 years ago, when here in New York City, there were only two factions which organized any protests. There was one very small, very marginalized faction, which was organized by the War Resisters League in Washington Square Park. And the only other people who were doing anything were the people who were marching with the International Action Center. And you actually had the bizarre, and here the so-called Red-Brown Alliance or Eurasianist Alliance, which Kevin just referred to. This is it in action, okay? Where, you know, the so-called radical left, so-called communist, making common cause with fascists quite overtly. Is, you know, the International Action Center got together with the most reactionary elements of the Serbian emigre community in this city, and they were marching in the street, waving the Serbian flag around, chanting Serbia, Serbia, Serbia. At the same time, not only that U.S. bombs were falling on Serbia, but at the same time that the Serbian army and paramilitary forces were cleansing 800,000 Albanian peasants from Kosovo. So that was it. I just hit rock bottom. In terms of, you know, any hope for the prospects of anti-war opposition in this city or in this country at that point.
What are the possibilities now?
Exactly. What are the possibilities now? That's the question. What are the possibilities now? Have we learned anything since then? Well, I mean, if we want to talk about what the actual... factions which are coming together this time are... It's very fragmented. I understand, I'm not really quite sure what they've been doing. I understand that the Brecht Forum, in whose space we're in, are leading some kind of an effort. There's also a group which is meeting at Charas, which is leading some kind of effort. And then there's also a group which is calling itself ANSWER, which seems to have been subject to a hostile takeover by the International Action Center. And then there's, once again, the War Resisters League and the sort of, wimpy pacifist elements who actually did, to their credit, get quite a few thousand people up to Times Square a few weeks ago. So that was something. That was something. Is there anybody who hasn't spoken yet who wants to add anything? All right, Jay.
Well, the quick answer, I think, to whether there's any chance that the Americanness, you know, that America was behind this is. No, because it shut down Wall Street for nearly a week, and that was a pretty obvious result of what was going to happen to it, and that's the one thing they would never do. Also, Osama bin Laden hasn't actually come out and said he was behind it, but he said that the people who did it are heroes who are going to heaven, so I think it's safe to say that he doesn't think the Israelis did it. But I have to come back to this thing of that the idea of how can we present to the people that what Osama bin Laden's demand, you know, his demands are legitimate. I don't think his demands are legitimate any more than the Bush administration's demands are legitimate. The Bush administration's demands, of course, are that at this point the Taliban be removed and that there not be this society that's making women, you know, cover themselves head to toe and be accompanied by male relatives. But that's not what that's a step. They want that so that they can then have their way and run the world and run the oil,
right, but,
you know,
but,
American
but, but
corporate
but
and oil interests can run the world.
Nonetheless, it's a legitimate demand.
Yeah, it's a legitimate demand.
And it's serving
demand,
their propaganda purposes.
Right, so to the degree that the Bush administration's demands are legitimate, then Osama bin Laden's demands are legitimate because he wants an end to the bombing of Iraq and he wants an end to the occupation of Palestine and so on. But he wants these things, to U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia, but he wants these things so that the entire world can be turned into an extreme right-wing fundamentalist Wahhabi state of a kind that even the Saudi monarchy would not be happy with.
No arguments.
Okay. I just think that should be clear when we talk. If we're going to talk to the American people and to our fellow New Yorkers, whatever, about this.
That's why I said, you know, his methods are criminal and his ideology is totalitarian, which is why it puts us in a real bind that he's making...
Yeah, his ultimate demand.
Now we can't say... Well, actually, maybe you can say... Certainly you can say a state for the Palestinians, because even Bush is saying that. But it's going to be more difficult for you to say U.S. out of Saudi Arabia without, you know, you being open to charges of being a terrorist or a terrorist sympathizer, blah, blah, blah. Bill?
It's going to be very hard to remove the... it's a weapon... when they call it a weapons-grade...
Got a source on this? I'd love to see it, Bill.
I'm just reading the media.
Well, where'd you get that?
NPR.
If you can get me a source, I'd appreciate it.
Okay.
The question is, does the Pentagon tell them everything?
Yeah, exactly.
What their anthrax program is, you know?
No.
Oh. Yep. Where do you see India in the Kashmir situation?
Well, the
it's going to keep both India and Pakistan happy.
Well, India and Pakistan are not happy. India and Pakistan were shelling, were lobbing shells at each other just 3 weeks ago, as you're aware. And the even though they're both ostensibly a part of this anti-terrorist coalition, the so-called Islamic militants, which actually are terrorists in which Pakistan is backing in Kashmir.
Tell you about the freedom fighters.
Yeah, exactly. Are trained in the same. In the same training camps, which are run by Osama bin Laden's Al Qaeda in Afghanistan, which is another reason why the Pakistan secret police was so cozy with the Taliban, because after the U.S. put pressure on them and said, "Look, you've got to get these terrorists out of Pakistan," they said, "Okay, fine, we'll just move them over to Afghanistan," which is what they did. And the same terrorist training camps, which the U.S. has been shelling in Afghanistan, were actually being used by Pakistan to train their terrorists to blow up targets in the Indian part of Kashmir. So, and until recently, India, like Iran, was a part of the de facto Russian alliance against Pakistan and the Taliban.
Well, so, you see that being reactivated?
What's that?
You see that? That
exactly. That's another one. It's another element which right now we're not supposed to talk about, not supposed to look at. Because now we're all supposed to be a part of this buddy-buddy anti-terrorist coalition, but that whole conflict could reemerge with a vengeance in the near future.
Yeah. I'm curious, this night link is, how do the OPEC and the non-OPEC petroleum-producing countries...
Dan, you may know more than I do.
The latest news on OPEC is that they're putting the squeeze on oil prices to...
They're
trying to force the non-OPEC members to raise the prices accordingly.
Which is what Hugo Chavez in Venezuela has been trying to do for quite some time, is to raise the oil prices. And Venezuela is an OPEC member. Right. And it's largely been the Saudis who have been too conciliatory, keep out pumping out the oil and keeping the price down.
Their critical importance to America is not the amount of oil that they sell. Because
but setting the price
their proportion of American oil from Saudi Arabia is only slightly more than Venezuela. It's important, but it's 10% or something of the imports. It's that they're the people who can set the oil prices where America wants them.
Okay, but what's their aim in keeping them low?
They can raise or lower them.
The conventional wisdom is that their aim in keeping the oil prices low is so that they can maintain their market share. And ever since the oil crunch of the 1970s, before the oil crunch of the 1970s, the U.S. was getting 60% of its oil from Saudi Arabia. Now it's down to 10-15%. And they've been very concerned about maintaining their market share. The conventional wisdom is that's why the Saudis keep it low. And I don't know if that's the truth or not. I will say that I do question the conventional wisdom that the U.S., as if it was a single hegemonic entity, wants low oil prices. I think that there's elements, particularly in the oil industry, which wants high oil prices because it mandates further development. And Caspian Basin oil on the west side in Kazakhstan, or east side in Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan, the reason that the development has not gone forward as quickly as they were hoping 10 years ago is because the oil prices have been too damn low. There's just been too much oil on the market. So I think that there's elements of the oil industry in this country who actually want the prices to be higher.
I didn't say that they kept them low. I said that they can keep them where America wants, which can fluctuate with the geopolitical...
Right. But is it where America wants or where they want?
When I say America, I don't mean you and me. I mean the ruling class.
Right,
but they have the Saudi rulers are very closely tied to the American rulers. They
right,
work
but,
more
but,
than
but
they
their,
like
interest,
to
their,
show
their interests are not necessarily 100% aligned.
Because it seems like Fox and the U.S. are more closely aligned.
Through Chavez or Chavez really? I know Chavez has made some deals with. Does Chavez have a...
All the way around. Venezuela's supplying Cuba with oil.
Right. Venezuela's supplying Cuba with oil. But does Chavez sort of counter the United States in Central Latin America?
Certainly with, he's been open about doing it with Fidel. And I think that he's been less open about doing it with the FARC guerrillas,
right.
Although he's accused of it. But he's pretty open about this whole, ideology of Bolivarianism, which he's promoting. Which would be some kind of new anti-imperialist bloc in Latin America. which, you know, I mean, I suppose we would have a certain amount of sympathy towards, and I will say that the new constitution, which he pushed through in Venezuela, has got some very progressive elements to it, such as autonomous self-government for indigenous peoples. But, you know, he's also, he calls himself a Bolivarian, but we can call him a Bonapartist. I mean, it's a one-man show, you know. It's a cult of personality, which I'm not too crazy about.
Have made common cause with the Al-Qaeda and something to do with the anthrax.
I don't think it's totally from left field. There's been a lot of speculation about that, as a matter of fact. I was recently talking to the people from the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles, which is a sort of a watchdog group on anti-Semitism. And, you know, I've got some problems with their pro-Israel stance and their enthusiasm for censorship of Nazis. But nonetheless, I consider it to be a pretty credible source. And they recently documented that, in fact, they boasted, this is what I mean by censorship, they boasted they helped shut down an international meeting which had been called for Lebanon by the Hezbollah with William Pierce, who's the author of the Turner Diaries and the head of the National Alliance in this country, and David Duke and some Holocaust revisionists from Europe and so on. They were all supposed to get together and have this powwow in Beirut, which was to be hosted by the Hezbollah. And the Simon Wiesenthal Center and some European governments put pressure on the government of Lebanon, which then, you know, barred the meeting. So, no, it's not so totally out of left field, actually. And I wish it was more out of left field. Anybody else, or should we start to wrap it up? In the two issues I brought of Native Americans, I've got the pieces which deal with precisely these issues, particularly as they relate to Mexico and Central America. Anybody wants to check one out, that'd be great. Anybody have anything else to say about what we can do here in New York? Come out to
we don't have a name for it yet.
The
group that's the anarchist anti-war group, which is meeting on Thursday night, of course.
Thursday or tomorrow?
Thursday.
But tomorrow, the anarchist roundtable is meeting. But I thought you were talking about the group that was nameless as yet, that was the...
They're both meeting at the A.J. Musty Room, 339 Lafayette Street.
But on different nights.
But on different nights.
That's right. Okay.
Anybody else?
Maybe it wasn't clear as to which group is meeting which night. Anarchist Roundtable tomorrow night. That's a broad group that's trying to do mutual aid among anarchists and change... Tell other anarchist groups what's going on, what they're doing, how can I help, etc. Thursday night meeting, which is going to be at 6:30 at the Musty Room, although they start a little late. The group that you and I and Steve Rabinowitz and Petra are up with that wants to try and get more anarchist anti-war education things going. I think fitting in talking about just now. Of trying to do something that hasn't been done before, for getting out the word to different people. That's going to be on Thursday night. The meetings this week are intense. And just to mention that the meeting forum in December is going to be Peter Lambert Wilson on Luddites and anti-Luddites. And so just so you remember.